It is 25 minutes to one. This is a live 90.5. You are listening to Business Insights with Mario and Matt. My first show live with Mario, and I'm very, very, very excited to be here.
That's correct, ladies and gentlemen. And it's a true pleasure to welcome our second guest. To all interested to know about father's rights, please visit the website align905.com.au. Today after 6:30, and you can hear the interview with Clary Holden, Father's Rights Australia. And you can learn more how you as a father, you can, you know, be looked after in the sense of knowing your rights, and if you need a friendly advice or somebody to talk with, you can hit the contact details over there. However, it's time to move our second guest, and it's a true pleasure to meet somebody from Australian Army. Like, let me share my past. Somebody who's a shared, not a major rank, but Major Andrew Andy Brayshaw, it's retired. Army veteran with 43 years military service behind him, 24 of those years were spent as a combat medic in the British Army, and the reminder as a combat medic, an officer in the Australian Army. Andy, welcome to the studio.
Welcome. Pleased to meet you.
Andy, please share with me, Britain, Australia, what, you didn't like it enough rain in the UK, so you decided to come to Australia? So, like, it's like, oh, it's a better food in Australian Army. Share with us, eh?
That's what a lot of people tend to think. Now, the reason why I came over here is in the British Army, you can only do a maximum of 22 years. And I was 16 when I joined the Army, so by the time I was 40, I'd completed my 22 years.
Yeah.
So I applied to join the Australian Army because they were looking for recruits.
Yeah.
And I came over as a lateral transfer in 2002, and that's how I got here.
Oh, okay. That's the part, eh? Look, I just spent 10 years in military. That's enough. I mean, 43 years. It's a long time.
Yeah. I wasn't intending to stay in that long. I was just, looking at doing.
I was just
looking at doing a couple of years. And I sort of got the bug, and it sort of, it's just one of those things that, oh, this is a good life. I don't mind this.
And I can see that you are the part of the UN in my country, ex-country Croatia, but you've been in Germany, Cyprus, Hong Kong, Africa, Persian Gulf, former Republic of Yugoslavia, as we know, the Croatia, Bosnia, and Serbia, and. Many unspecified operations. Well, we're not talking about this one. So, Matt, would you like to be kind and you start interviewing our guest?
So absolutely.
You are surrounded with Darren and myself now, and there is no questions being printed for Andy or nothing like this. So, please, Matt.
Yeah, and by the way, firstly, thank you for your service. 43 years is a long time. It is a long time. What kept you in for so long? And what made you, also what inspired you to join the Army in the first place?
Well, I joined the Army in the first place because it's something I always wanted to do as a kid. I always liked playing soldiers and that, as we do when we're a little one. And I thought, it's getting to the time I'm leaving school. What am I going to do with my career? I came from a mining village in the UK in a place called just outside Barnsley, and all my mates were going to work down the pits. I went down there once on a school excursion, and there's no way I was going to work underground in those conditions. So I thought, well, I'll go and join the Army. And there was a group of us, about six, that joined the Army. And out of those six, I was the one that everybody said wouldn't last 5 minutes. And 43 years later, I was the only one that was in. I think after 3 years, I was the only one still serving.
Oh, wow. So you turned it around. Anyway, flip the script.
Yep.
So when you were 16, were you certain this is exactly what I'm going to do?
Yeah. I knew I was going to join the Army. I went in there, obviously, because I was only 16, I had to get my mum's permission. She had to actually sign the paperwork to say, yeah, she was happy for me to join. I think she did it a little bit too quickly, because we were seven kids, so I think she was glad to get rid of one of them. So that's what I did. And, it's been rough, but I've never looked back. And if I had to do it all over again, I would do.
Just on that, because it's really interesting, your mum having to sign you off. How did your parents take it at the time, having
my mum was okay with it. My stepfather, he wasn't too bothered. My mum was okay with it. She was ex-military anyway. She did a bit of time in the in the Women's Army when she was younger, and that's where she met my dad, because he was in the Army as well. So, of course, it was a little bit of a tradition. I was the only one out of the family, of all my brothers and sisters, that had any interest in the military. So I was the only one that took it forward. And I'm trying to persuade my grandchildren to join up, but my daughters keep telling me to shut up, so...
Can I share some sentiment or maybe recollection? You're the combat medic.
Yep.
Can you explain to us what it means, a combat medic? Is this like a you know, like a Hollywood movie, and everybody's calling like, oh, doc, you know, and then the guy like comes and rip the shirts and saw everything. And so.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. Imagine you're a paramedic turning up at a scene of an accident. When there's explosions going off all around you and gunshots going off around you, that's the sort of atmosphere that we train for. Admittedly, it's not always like that, but that's the ultimate aim of a combat medic, is to treat the soldier on the front line when they get wounded.
That's very interesting. Look, I see in your profile that you manned a military ambulance during 1979, during the UK's winter of discontent. What is that all about? I mean, 79, I was 7 years old. Matt was not even playing. And Darren was... No, you weren't
even... Darren's
not even born yet. So
I wasn't even 18 back then. Basically, what the winter of discontent was, the UK was going through a lot of major strikes. All the sort of the public services and everything were going on strike. The car workers, Ford and that, they're all asking for exorbitant amount of money in pay rises, which the government just wasn't willing to give. So all the public services came out, and part of that coming out was that the ambulance service, they went on strike and they refused to answer 999 calls, which is equivalent to your triple zeros.
Yeah.
So basically the government had to do something. So they called in the military and the military medics.
Military doesn't go on strike, eh? So.
I said, we're not allowed to go on strike. So they called us in, and as I said, I hadn't been out of training all that long, and I was thrown in at the deep end. Mm-hmm. And I went up to Manchester with a couple of my mates from my unit, and we manned ambulances for about 10 weeks.
10 weeks?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. 10 weeks.
Yeah. You must have said, and also just back on what you were saying earlier, you joined the army at such a young age, being 16. What was it like going to war at such a young age?
It was really, I was 21 when I first went to war. So I was, 21 is quite a young age to really go to war. It's about sort of the average age of the soldiers that went in World War One. It was for the Falklands. The Falklands had been invaded by the Argentinians. And unfortunately, they weren't counting on Maggie Thatcher, who was the Prime Minister at the time. And she said, well, no, I'm not having that. So she raised the task force, and off we went. And I must admit, as we were sailing down to the Falklands, we were all thinking, we're going to get so far, then they're going to say, nah, turn round, it's all over with. And it wasn't until the General Belgrano got sunk by the submarine Conqueror that we realised, looks like this might actually happen. And then, of course, that's when you really start to sort of worry, okay, what's going to happen? Am I going to make it back? How am I going to, react? Will I make it? All that sort of stuff.
It's a long journey. What's the distance from UK to Falkland? 4,000 kilometres, something, more?
It was 8,000 miles.
8,000 miles. Yeah. So that's about 60, that's a double almost, no?
Yeah.
That's 60,000 kilometres, yeah.
Yeah, 8,000 miles. It took us, we sailed, there was a lot of ships. The government commandeered a lot of ships, cruise liners, QE2, Canberra, things like that.
Yeah.
I was unfortunate. We sailed down on a Townsend Tourism car ferry, which was built for going across the English Channel.
Yeah.
So think of the Spirit of Tasmania.
Yeah.
That's the sort of boat I went down on. And it took us about 3 weeks to get there. And it wasn't a very comfortable
isn't it interesting? I'm sorry to now interfere with this one. It's been televised on those days. I saw the documentary, it was the TVs and, the farewells from the dockyards and everything else. And Argentinians had so much time to prepare, but you still kicked their ass.
Oh, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening live 90.5 Business Insights with Mari and Matt. We'll take a short break. And our guest in studio, retired Major Australian Army and British Army, Andy, will continue his conversation with us, because this conversation is not just being in the Army and how cold was in England and the reason why the Mr. Andy came in Australia, but something more better which is going to help you and enlighten you. You're listening live 90.5 Business Insights with Matt and Mario.
It's 10 minutes to 1. This is Business Insights with Matt and Mario. On this Friday afternoon, we have a lovely guest in studio, Andrew, who has spent 43 years in the military serving for the British and Australian Army. Yeah. And so my next question for you is, What was going through your mind when you knew at 21 years old you were going to the army? What was going through your head?
Well, all sorts of things go through your head when you're facing that situation like that. You know, you wonder, okay, will my training work? Will I remember everything I learnt in training? How many of us are going down? How many of us are coming back? All that sort of stuff.
What was the training like?
The training was quite intense. We went to a place called the Brecon Beacons in Wales to do a lot of our pre-deployment training. And the funny thing was, when we were actually anchored off in San Carlos Water, ready to go ashore, and we looked out at the land that we were facing, it looked just like the Welsh mountains, as if we hadn't gone far. And the funny thing is, when the Falklands were invaded, the first thing we said to ourselves, because we were skiing in Scotland at the time, the first thing we said was, how did the hell did the Argentinians get to Scotland without us knowing about it? Because we'd never even heard of the Falkland Islands Falklands before. Yeah. We thought it was somewhere in Scotland.
But you were the Falklands. just Andy, just a few curiosity. Compare me 16 years old Andy to the 16 years old boys now.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. That was Please continue.
I'm what we call, I'm the old school, and I feel that a lot of youngsters today, they wouldn't be in as much trouble as they were if they had the opportunities that I had within the military. Yeah. A lot of people are scared to join. You don't have to join the military. And I don't feel there's a focus a lot on the military these days. So you don't get a lot of youngsters that actually want to take that as a career, or even just to, you know, have a go and try. And it's the making of a lot of people. And all the guys that I joined up with at 16, most of us did at least 9 years each. And you know that they wouldn't regret it. They'd go back in a heartbeat.
I think you and I are very old people, because you know, I do remember I was 14 years old when my grandfather sent me military school, naval military school, and in communism it was that way. You know, you're going high school from 14 to 18, and then academy as an equality university. And I do remember if you don't go in the army, any, you know, air force, navy, whatever it is, whatever it comes to you, you are not considered as a man. Yep. Right, society will actually reject you. You know what I mean? That was interesting. But today, it's the opposite. You know what I mean? Like, people don't want to join in the army. So, mate, you know, imagine yourself 16 years old. You know what I mean? Wear the uniform. You know what I mean? And live the, you know, nice warm bed, and somebody comes to you. What time did you wake up in British Army in your barracks?
We used to get up about 5:30. We'd get up in the morning.
Yeah, that's a 5:30. Yeah, that's a beautiful time to wake up in the morning.
Especially in the middle of the winter. The first thing you're going to do is go for a run over the hills.
And when you compare the differences between Australia and British Army, what's the major differences you saw?
When I first came over here, I did notice a big difference. I mean, I retired from the British Army as a regimental sergeant major, so the highest of the soldiers. I came over here, and it took a while to get used to. The Australians, they had a lot more laid-back attitude.
Man, no way.
I wonder. Yeah, so, and so what impact did that have in the Army, do you think? With the more laid-back attitude, how did that affect it?
I don't know. It took me a while to get used to it. I mean, I was so used to, you know, somebody
drill,
saying...
Drill, do this, and you did it. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, admittedly, gone over days where if you didn't do it, then you got a good hiding for not doing it. But, you know, there seems to be a lot more questioning of why we're going to do things rather than just get ahead and do it.
Now, after 43 years in the military, so let's go from the, you know, on the more serious stuff. 43 years in the army, military, being combat, it's nothing. So let's go on the more serious stuff, Matt. What do you think what's happened to somebody who spends 43 years in military and seeing a lot of things and being the combatant?
I was going to say, you would have seen a lot of things, a lot of stories. Mental health side of things, how did that affect you?
Yeah.
Did it affect you?
Oh, yeah. It does affect us. I mean, I first experienced sort of a few mental issues with my service was the first time I actually got sort of diagnosed with anything was back in 1983, which was about 6 months after we came back from the Falklands. And what transpired was I was working in an Army medical centre. A young soldier came in. He says, "Oh, I saw the medic last night," because I was doing the sick parade. He says, "I saw the medic last night," and he said this. I went, "Well, no, you didn't, because I was a medic last night." He says, no, it was the other medic," and pointed to one of the other medics. So I just got up, walked over to him and punched him in the face. And that's when we knew something was wrong. Okay, yeah. So we identified it. So eventually they sent me down to the military hospital in London, and I was there for a few days, and they sort of, back then they diagnosed me with what they call adjustment reaction disorder.
Adjustment reaction disorder.
That's so, trying to adjust.
What is the adjustment? This is like a commercial for the bed. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll take a short break. You're listening live 90.5 Business Insights with Matt and Mario. And now guest in studio, Andy's going to be squeezed more about his adjustment. And what has that been? We'll take a short break and come back, and we'll continue our conversation and interview with a guest in studio, Major Andy. You're listening live 90.5 Business Insights with Mario and Matt. You're listening live 90.5 Business Insights with Mario and Matt, and we'll continue our interview with a Major, retired Major 43, in a military service from British Army to Australian Army. And Matt, the last thing we spoke, that our guest in studio has been sent to some adjustments. Would you like to take it over?
Absolutely. One thing you mentioned, which was really interesting, adjustment reaction syndrome.
Yep.
What's that?
Yeah, basically it's what you call now PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, back then the Brits referred to it as adjustment reaction disorder. So that was us sort of getting, you know, adjusted to things. But it's been several names before it became PTSD. It's been called battle shock. Was one thing that we used to use in the sort of the late 80s, early 90s. And more recently, of course, PTSD is what everybody knows about.
Yeah. And was this something that you mentioned beforehand it was something that you did have? Is it something you still carry with you to this day, do you think?
Yeah. It's like I tell people, PTSD, it's not something you can cure. You learn to manage it, but you cannot cure it.
What would be the biggest tip you would give to anyone that is currently having PTSD?
What I would say is seek help. Speak with people, even if it's just a member of your family. Good thing I've had is always had my wife to rely on. She's been a rock. She's seen me through a lot of bad times, but yeah, it's very hard when you hold it in. I mean, I've lost a lot of friends that have just, you know, just can't go on anymore, and sort of the demons have finally caught up with them, and the only way they see out is to end it all.
Interesting yeah. enough,
it's interesting.
Can I just join you for this one? Okay, so I always come back to one thing only. You know, we are born, and our parents do everything to be happy, healthy, you know, all these things, right? And then one day we decide to go in the army. Now, army, it's not a holiday camp. People think that what they see on TV, it's a beautiful and a mean and everything else. It is not. The army, it's a lot of sacrifices and a lot of sacrifice to achieve the objectives, key objectives, which merely looks impossible, but you do it. However, there's a paradox of the military. You know, you don't go in military just to parade around the streets and look nice in uniforms. Like, once upon a time, I was so slim and I had a nice uniform. But then happens something what we know as a war. Instead of going into depth in definition of the war it is, then the boys like yourself, 16, 18, 20, you know, you are trained, you're prepared, went in the war, but then we come back different. We age. We lose the senses which we had before, and society somehow puts stigmata on like yourself or me or anybody else who suffer PTSD due to combat. How do you feeling when your society just a clapping on a particular day, you know what I mean, thank you the veterans and the soldiers, but at 364 days in a year nobody cares?
Yeah, it can be difficult at times. You know, people like on Anzac Day, Remembrance Sunday, things like that, you get the people, they're here, they're supporting the troops and everything. But their attitude towards the military is very different at times. People don't think about, you know, what the guys are going through, how the guys are suffering, how the guys are actually trying to cope. They see that the guy on the outside looks really good, look fit, healthy and all that stuff, but they don't realise what's actually going on inside the mind. And that's one of the hardest things, is getting people to understand, you know, what we've been through, and basically to understand that we might look okay on the outside, but it's the inside where all the problems are occurring. And the problem we have is we don't want to put it onto our families and that.
Yes.
So we'll sort of hold it in.
You know, the funny thing is, I was just reading now recently, and I can relate this to young Matt. We don't see what's going something inside of us, and we are camouflaging this very well, particularly soldiers, because as you say, like, you don't want to hurt the family, and then we turn into the different vices, maybe drugs, maybe alcohol, silence, disengagements, and, you know, many things. Been there, done that. But overall, it is a invisible enemy of the healthy person being sent, and they come back the damage and dented, and society, you know, do what they do. But after all, it's a people like yourself helping those with PTSD. Now, I know, Matt, maybe you didn't know, but share with you, our guest in studio writes the books as well. So what's your books about, Andy?
Yeah, well, I'm working on 3 books at the moment.
We can't talk about Dr. Seuss, okay? It's not politically correct,
no,
okay?
Well, I don't know whether it'd be politically correct, because there will be a bit of language in it.
Yes.
Don't forget, I'm a soldier. But one of the books is called The Medic's War. And that's basically that's based on my experiences during the Falklands War as a 21-year-old soldier, and how we felt and the things that we went through. My other book that's sort of halfway through is called Demons Rising, Living with PTSD. And that's about how PTSD has affected me over the years, the problems I've had, how I've tried to cope with the problems.
Yes.
Just to give some sort of insight into, you know, exactly what it is that we're going through. And then the other book which was the first book I started that I still haven't finished yet, is called No More Heroes. And it's about basically my military career. So not just the Falklands, but the whole of my military career through the British Army. You know, looking at the Falklands War, the First Gulf War, my time in the in Croatia with the UN, and a few other little things that I've done, things that I've been involved in. Because I've done a lot of work for charity and stuff as well during my time. And I think that's why people think I'm mad, because some of the things I've done have actually been quite mad.
Well, madness or not, but you are still kept the humanity inside yourself and kindness. So despite the problems and obstacles you faced in 43 years in military, and that's a long, long time. I was reading something a long time ago in academy, and they told us why the Napoleon was losing war in Russia. It's not just because, you know, Battle of Borodino or the winter and everything else. It was soldier fatigue, being separated from the home for the, you know, duration of a couple of years, and, you know, turning the enemy to himself. But then there was not PTSD. You know, you need to be man. You know, I mean, how dare you to say this? And the First World War, like shell shocks, what they call them,
yep.
And these things, like, they didn't want to admit that the people suffering. This young gentleman, Matt, who is a very privileged, and know him, he was suffering inside deeply, deeply. Nobody didn't know. But even he says, I camouflaged everything so people think I'm the perfect. So, Andy, how do you help people who are coping with PTSD?
Well, I like to think that, you know, I've always been there to talk with other guys. Some of my mates have reached out to me. They've been having bad times. So I said, let's have a chat, let's have a drink. Yeah. So it's just, you know, just knowing that there's somebody there who's been through it. It's all right. I mean, there's a lot of do-gooders out there, and I've got nothing against the do-gooders, but a lot of them try to help us. They've not actually been through it. And it's a lot harder to try and understand how somebody's feeling if you haven't actually lived in their shoes.
Correct. So, yes, Matt.
Hey, Andrew, I also wanted to ask, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, opening up was quite a tough step for you. I'm curious as to how you went about it. That being that first step, actually reaching out for support, asking for support. Not what brought you to the place, but what helped you go to there?
There's been, over the years, there's been a combination of things. Sometimes I haven't reached out for support. I've tried to cope with things myself, which is what a lot of guys do. Other times, I've had to reach out because of things that have happened. So people realise, you know, things aren't quite, you know, aren't tickety-boo with this guy. Something's wrong. Let's try and find out what's wrong with him. Let's have a talk to him. And that basically that's the way it's always been. Most of the time I've tried to hide it, but, you know, you can only hide it for so long. And then, you know, people that know you, they start to notice that something's not quite right with this person. He's different in some way. And they can't put the finger on it, but they know something's not right. And that's when we sort of start our conversations. And then hopefully, you know, somebody will say, oh, right, yeah, well, you got a bit of a problem there. Let's have a talk. Let's refer you to somebody who might be able to help and all that sort of stuff. I mean, back in 2012, I had a really, really bad episode of PTSD. I was off work for about 18 months with it. I was really suffering bad. And the... you know, I was on medications, I was on lots of things. One of my main problems was I used to cope with my PTSD through running because I was really keen fit. I was a marathon runner. I used to do ultra marathons. I used to run long distances, raising money for charity. So every time I got really et up with my PTSD, I used to go for a nice long run, and I'd think of nothing, going out for about 2-3 hours and just running, just totally switching off and running, and just listening to the sounds around me, listening to the, you know, the birds and that. And that's how I used to cope with it. And then when I was down at the Army Recruit Training Center in Kapuka, back in 2010, I had an accident when I slipped and injured my back. So I couldn't run, and unfortunately, I've not been able to run since. So, of course, I lost my main coping mechanism. And when you lose your coping mechanism and you haven't got another way to do it, that's when things really start to get on top of you. And there has been times, you know, where I thought, you know, is it really worth it? Am I going to go on? But luckily, touch wood, I've sort of managed to sort of pick myself up out of those by thinking of the positive things that are in my life, like the family, my grandkids, my wife, that sort of stuff. And hopefully, you know, they will help to see me through some of the bad times.
So your kids and your wife, your family, you say that's the dynamic and the driving force that keeps you going to this day?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, you know, I think about, you know, okay, if I did end it all, how would they cope? How would it affect them? You know, is it really fair to put them through it all? All right, my suffering might be over with, but their suffering would only just beginning. And, you know, and that's one of the main driving forces that stopped me. But unfortunately, there's a lot of guys out there that, you know, it just gets too much. And I've lost lots of friends through PTSD. This year alone, I've had two of my friends have taken their own lives as a result of PTSD. And it's just, you know, it's one of the things. From the Falklands War, we lost 250 soldiers in the service personnel in the Falklands War. Since the end of the Falklands War, more than double that have actually taken their own lives.
Wow. You know, yes, please, Matt. You know.
No. I was going to say, so you've had two friends who have ended their own lives this year. By the way, I'm very sorry to hear that. Looking back, do you feel like they would have showed signs that they were struggling, that they were really finding it tough, even though they did go to the war with you?
Yep.
Yeah.
The problem is, you know, we learn to hide it. Unfortunately, there's still the stigma around PTSD within the military. And although they say, you know, we're going to look after our soldiers, we're going to treat them right, we're going to make sure they get okay, but there's still that stigma around PTSD, and guys just don't want to, you know, they don't want to reach out for the help because they're going to think, oh, this is going to end my career, they're going to get rid of me, you know, that's it, I've finished in the military, nobody wants anything to do with me. And unfortunately, no matter what people say, that stigma is still around, and until we can actually deal with that stigma and totally get rid of the stigma, we're always going to have problems where guys just aren't going to cope.
Couldn't agree more. So what do you think the next steps are to overcoming that stigma and just abolishing it?
I think we need to, you know, not only say we're here, we're going to help, but we need to actually physically show that, you know, we are helping the soldiers. We are helping them with the problems, and that the soldier actually feels that he is being helped.
That's very interesting. You know, what I'm listening, what I want to know, Andy, and, you know, generosity and kindness in you, it's truly something like I immensely respect, because after all 43 years in military service, seeing the things, but yet you're on a field helping different shape or forms to society and those who need the most, particularly through your books and your knowledge, expertise. So if somebody wants, you know, discuss with you how we can help them to PTSD, how they can best contact you?
Best way to contact me at the moment would be on LinkedIn, because that's the only social media I'm using at the moment. I am in the process of building a website, and obviously once I get my website up and running, it'll be done, but it's not one of my priorities at the moment. My main priority is trying to get my books finished, because hopefully the books, especially the one about PTSD, will be an avenue for people to look at and say, oh yeah, this guy, he suffered, but you know, there's strategies there that we can utilize.
Andy, thank you very much for being our guest today for the last 65 minutes. I truly appreciate it. We're going to have you again in the studio. And everybody who is admiring this man, and you should admire this man, enjoy this conversation. Join us on website at live905.com.au today after 6:30. There's going to be an entire interview with Andy Rashon. And just shorten out your name. I'm not like a Matt. He knows to speak English. You know what I mean? So I need to shorten up my words. Andy, thank you for being our guest today. And I want to say thank you to, on behalf to everybody who reached you out. He's going to reach you out. And you helped them with your guidance and wisdom. Truly thank you.
My pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Live 90.5 Business Insights with Mario and Matt, and we'll take a short break with our next guest directly from Taiwan. And stay with us. You're going to love it.
Alive 90.5.